Hello and welcome to Total Film's Last Picture Show. I'm Matt Matem, Deputy Editor of Total Film, and the elevator pitch for this is, it's the end of the world and you have one more day at the cinema. What four films are you programming? Today's guest is Joe Cornish, a filmmaker and former TV and radio presenter who first came to prominence in the 90s as one half of Adam and Joe, with his comedy partner Adam Buxton. Their lo-fi series, The Adam and Joe Show, featured irreverent sketches and skits, and they went on to host extremely popular radio shows together on XFM and BBC Six Music. Since then, Joe has embarked on his own filmmaking career, writing and directing his breakout hit Attack the Block back in 2011, which was followed by The Kid Who Would Be King in 2019. With Edgar Wright, he's also worked on the screenplays for Steven Spielberg's The Adventures of Tintin and Marvel's Ant-Man. Now, he's just written and directed his first TV show, Lockwood & Co. It's adapted from the book series by Jonathan Stroud, and it follows a trio of young ghost hunters in an alternate London. He directs the first and last episode of the eight-part series and serves as an executive producer throughout. All eight episodes of Lockwood & Co. are available to stream on Netflix now.
My name's Lucy. I've ended up in an agency run by two boys.
My name's Lockwood. You need a ladder.
That's George. His weird mate with zero social skills.
You'd better tell her about the biscuit roll. She can't just go taking two at once.
How about we find ourselves a ghost?
I'm working with maniacs.
So, welcome to Total Film's Last Picture Show, Joe Cornish.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. And you're probably the first guest we've had who I would consider to be radio slash podcasting royalty. So, if you have any sort of tips along the way, please feel free to throw them in.
Okay.
Before we get started with your film program for the last day in a cinema, let's talk about your new project, which is Netflix show Lockwood & Co., which is made by your production company, which you co-founded, Complete Fiction.
That's right. Myself, Edgar Wright, Naira Park, Rachel Pryor. We are Complete Fiction.
And so Lockwood & Co. is based on a series of books by Jonathan Stroud. How did it come to you? Did you discover the books? Did someone bring it to you and say they thought you'd be good at adapting this?
They did, yeah. Rachel Pryor, who is one of the members of Complete Fiction. I'm talking about us like we're some exciting band. She discovered the books about 10 years ago when there was only one book, The Screaming Staircase. And she thought they were brilliant. She showed that book to me. I thought it was brilliant, but the rights were snapped up by a Hollywood studio. Fast forward 10 years later, there are five books. The rights become available again. We call up the author, Jonathan Stroud. He's familiar with our work. We sweet talk him. We get the rights. We sweet talk Netflix. And here we are, eight episodes, January the 27th, Netflix.
So what was it that appealed to you about adapting the books? And do you think that's the same thing that will appeal to viewers about watching it?
I think so. You know, I'm a big fan of supernatural movies and stories. And this book series has a really simple, really original hook, or a few of them, actually. The first is that ghosts kill you if they touch you, which is really clever and kind of obvious, and it's amazing no one has done it before, because what can ghosts do? They can scare you, throw furniture at you, possess your kids. You know, even in Ghostbusters, you can point your proton pack at them, and then they can throw food at you, but you never really get in a combat situation. So that's what's great about this book, and also the idea that these books, I should say. Also the idea that that iron repels them, that salt burns them. All these fairly basic elements have a practical use against them. And then the third idea, which is kind of an old idea, is that young people are more sensitive to the supernatural. So combine those things and you have the kind of building blocks for this really clever world where the technological digital revolution has never happened because suddenly everyone goes into smelting and salt mining in order to deal with this ghost epidemic. And then you have this kind of Dickensian situation where young people are employed by agencies run by adults and exploited in order to fight the ghosts. So it's a really clever premise, and it's a simple premise. It's not super complex. You know, our first episode just starts by following these two young people with these peculiar weapons into this haunted house. You kind of learn the methodology as you go along, rather than have some big exposition dump at the beginning. And the books are just really beautifully written, and the characters at the center of it are really compulsive to me.
And how did you find it, having directed two features in the past, overseeing an eight-episode TV show like this?
You know, I treated my two episodes, I do the first episode and the last episode, so I treated those just like I was making a movie, and I was worried that maybe I wouldn't have the time or the resources, but you know, Naira, my producer, is so brilliant, and it just felt exactly like making a film.
Mm.
The experience of then having these other two really wonderful directors, Will and Catherine, come on and do the other six was interesting in so much as I was able to come in after they'd shot and help shape their material in the way that producers would advise me on my material as a director.
Mm.
So it was kind of cool to be on the other side of the table, or wear the different hat, or whatever metaphor you want to choose. And in the future, I think it'll make me a bit more objective about the stuff that I've shot. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Because when you actually stand there on the set, you always have a very firm intention for what you're doing. But in post, you might make it better by changing your intention. So maybe it'll make me more amenable to that kind of thing, if that makes sense.
And Lockwood & Co., like your films, has young protagonists. Is that something that you're just always drawn to?
Well, I think it's more of a coincidence. You know, Snow Crash, Section 6, I had a bunch of movies that I tried to get off the ground in between with that aren't kind of young people versus supernatural things, but those happen to have been the stories that have got going. You know, Attack the Block was just an idea that came to me organically because of an experience I had. Kitty Would Be King was an idea I had when I was about 12, that same age as the character in it. This is Jonathan Stroud's books that were kind of brought to me. So I'm worried about becoming known as the guy that like does those movies, because I hope there's more strings to my bow. But at the same time, it's a really enjoyable thing to do, because I'm not working necessarily with actors who have huge careers behind them and have experienced the process so many times that they might not find it new and exciting. There's always a sense of discovery and adventure and optimism and excitement on set every day of working with younger actors. But these guys are in their early 20s, so I don't want to talk to them like it's some sort of school outing.
But on that note, though, what is the trick when it comes to casting a young lead? Because obviously in Lockwood & Co., you've got a trio at the centre, really. Mm.
Well, there's no real science to it, really, or magic to it. People walk in and you say to yourself, would I believe this person as that character? And sometimes they share some of the traits of the character in real life. Sometimes you think they share those traits, but actually they're just doing a really, really good audition.
Mm.
Ruby Stokes, for instance, just did an amazing audition. I think the scene we auditioned her was the scene in episode one where she is actually auditioning for Lockwood, where she comes in and her psychic abilities are tested. And we just believed in that audition that she was emotionally connecting to the stories that she felt when holding these objects, you know. Cameron came in very early, but we kind of missed him. We didn't see how good he was. And then we got really close to the wire and we couldn't find him. So we went all the way back to the tapes from the beginning and we realized we'd sort of overlooked him. We brought him back in and he just was amazing. And then Ali was just brilliant from the off. So you're looking for people who can embody the characters, and then you're looking for people who you think can deal with the rigors of shooting, which are not to be underestimated.
And how important is it to sort of film them as part of that process? Because do you ever meet people that you think will be good, but then something just doesn't quite work when they're actually on screen?
Yeah, you've got to do, especially the energy between them, like something we did on Attack the Block, you just bring them back again and again and again. It's a bit, in Attack the Block, it was a bit like forming a boy band. Do you know what I mean? So we'd bring them in different combinations and swap the roles around and just observe. And then you'd also observe when they weren't auditioning, whether they were getting on, whether they were friendly to each other, out of your sight kind of thing. So we did that on this as well. You do, you know, chemistry reads where you feel the energy between the characters. And in fact, Ruby was cast quite early on. So she would just tell us. We'd say, what did you think of him? She'd go, yeah, he was all right. What did you think of him? Oh, yeah, he was great, like that. You know, the relationship between Lockwood and Lucy in particular is core to the show. So to have that sort of on-off, I love you, I hate you energy was really important.
Did you have any films or shows that you used as sort of inspiration or reference points when it came to this?
Not really, you know. The thing about me, like you probably, is I've just watched so much stuff. You know, I've been watching movies like everyone since I was a tiny kid. I was going to the cinema on my own when I was 12. So my brain is just a huge melange of references. So I can never be specific. Sometimes I just catch myself doing something that is from another movie. I only realize afterwards, oh, man, I got that from. So the answer is no. But you know, my favorite ghost movies are probably like Jack Clayton's The Innocents with Deborah Kerr, which is phenomenal. Oh, well, we don't want to get into this, but yeah, there's hundreds of them.
And in terms of directing, do you know what you're going to be doing next? Is it going to be Attack the Block 2, or is it going to be another series of this, or does it depend how
it depends. I got a bunch of stuff, you know, very, very nearly ready to go. We're developing Attack the Block at the moment, John Boyega and I. So we're still working on that. I've got a kind of very fun horror movie that I've got with Netflix in the US. And I'm adapting Mark Miller's comic book Starlight, which is really brilliant. And then lots of other things. Yeah, so you never really know till the green light flashes.
Awesome. Well, now we're going to sort of ease into the Last Picture Show segment. Mm. And firstly, I just wanted to ask you before that, what's the first film you actually remember seeing at the cinema?
Well, the very first film I remember seeing at the cinema was Snow White, because I remember being terrified by the witch and being taken out of the cinema by my mummy. Then I remember The Jungle Book, which I saw at the Brixton Academy before it was a venue, when it was a cinema. Mm. First film I saw on my own was The Black Stallion when I was 11 or 12.
And into the Last Picture element, it's the end of the world and you're programming four films that you can watch at the cinema on your last day. You can either treat it lightly, or you can treat it as this is very seriously the apocalypse and it's the end of the world. Or it's just, you know, a fun four films you'd love to sort of program in the cinema. But what is the first film that you're playing?
Well, I think the first film I've chosen for my apocalyptic, what do you call it, like a quadrilogy? Yeah, that's a word they invented for the Alien box set. Anyway, I'm going to use it. The first film is Lindsay Anderson's If...
There's no such thing as a wrong war. Violence and revolution are the only pure acts.
Blood. Real blood.
Have you seen that movie?
Yes, I have. A long time.
Malcolm McDowell, directed by Lindsay Anderson. It's set in a British public school, and it is about the pupils staging a revolution, and at the climax, they machine gun the headmaster to death. So I saw this movie when I was about 15. Weirdly, it actually premiered on the day I was born, December the 20th, 1968. So it was already an old movie when I saw it. So the reason I'm showing it under these particular circumstances of the apocalypse is because it is a sort of two fingers up to the establishment, and it's a movie about the importance of revolutionary change. And I think that is a nice energy to go out on, especially if there's nothing you can do about being frazzled to death. It's nice to put a finger up to fate, you know. And it's just such a clever movie, particularly it uses a public boarding school as a sort of microcosm for British society. And it's surreal and funny and exciting and kind of punky. And it's a really unique film, I think.
Did you get to see it on the big screen?
I did. I went to see it at a place called The Scala, a repertory cinema in the King's Cross. Yeah, and I saw it a bunch of times. Saw it at the National Film Theatre. There's a beautiful Criterion Blu-ray of it. It's a really great movie. I do recommend it. And it's actually, in probably more than any other film, informed what I do in terms of young people staging a revolution against adults. I was so excited by that when I saw that movie. Weirdly, there is a sort of element of that in Lockwood & Co. and Attack the Block and Kid Who Would Be King, really.
Awesome. Well, a great film to start us off on. And before we get to your next film, do you have a favourite cinema where you would kind of like to be able to show these films?
I do, yeah. My favourite current cinema in London is the Curzon Mayfair, which is under threat at the moment, I think, of redevelopment, which would be an absolute sin, because it's one of the final untouched, complete, big screen West End cinemas. And I love it there. I live in Stockwell, so I can get on the Victoria Line and go straight to Green Park and just walk around the corner. I always see the Bond film there. Every Bond film I see at the Curzon Mayfair, because it's the embassies are all around it, and it feels like the kind of area of London where spies, if James Bond went to the cinema, that's where he'd see it. It's got this beautiful ceiling, fantastic acoustics, comfortable seats. I love the Curzon Mayfair, and I think it would be shocking if that cinema was redeveloped. I'd be very, very sad.
Mm. Well, on to the second film of your programme now. What are you picking for this one?
Okay, so the second film I will pick is going to be Close Encounters of the Third Kind, because it is sort of weirdly a film about death and transcendence.
Indianapolis, Aries 31 has traffic 2 o'clock, slightly above.
Can you say aircraft type?
Negative, center. No distinct outline. Tell you the truth, the target is rather brilliant. Wait a second. He's heading right for my windshield. The traffic is approaching head-on. Alter right and really moving. And right by us, right now. That was really close.
31, do you wish to file a report of any kind of it?
I wouldn't know what kind of report to file, center.
The original version, it's about somebody leaving the planet Earth and embracing something very frightening, like going on board that spaceship with those peculiar creatures. And he does sort of ascend to another plane and a different world. And I thought, well, okay, if I'm at this this film festival where the world is going to end, it's scary, it's quite long, it's got a good build-up. It's this amazing combination of sort of high fantasy and domestic drama, like the scenes of the marriage breakup are as powerful as a really great French movie or something. Special effects are still extraordinary because they use a lot of light flare, so they're not really attempting to portray particularly detailed creatures or anything. They just do it by suggestion using light. Even though the model work of the spaceship is incredible, the idea of using, I think, little girls from a ballet school in the alien suits. And it's an amazing movie. I saw it at a tender age when I didn't really know how the heck they were doing it. And then I think it would probably make me feel better about whatever was coming for me after the apocalypse.
And obviously you've worked with Steven Spielberg in the past. Did you get a chance to speak to him about it at all? Or do you keep any of the sort of fanboying aside when you're...
Did I talk to him about it? I don't think I did, because I know that he did a little cameo in Simon Pegg and Nick Frost's film, Paul. And I happen to know they rinsed him for alien anecdotes. So I didn't want to like go over that ground. I asked him about other things, but mainly it was, you know, we were in production. So there wasn't too much time for anecdotes.
And did that metaphor, that death metaphor, did that strike you the first time you saw it? Or was it something that kind of came to you in later rewatches?
I think it would have come to me in later rewatches. I don't know. When I first saw it, I think I was just amazed by the spectacle of it. But that shot when Roy Neary, Jaws character? I think he's called Roy Neary. He walks into the spaceship, he stretches his arms out, doesn't he? And he's like twice the height of any of the little aliens, and they reach up and hold his arms, almost like a rock star, sort of being carried, crowd surfing into the ship. It's sort of terrifying and transcendent at the same time, isn't it? But when Spielberg talks about it now, he says, oh, I wouldn't write that ending now, because as a family man, I wouldn't be able to leave my wife and child. Might be actually a fantasy for some fathers to get into a spaceship with a lot of children who appear to be able to look after themselves and go to another planet. I don't know.
For a couple of days at least.
For a couple of days, yeah. You would want to come back, definitely.
As someone, as you've said, who just grew up loving films, can you kind of keep your cool, basically, when you're working with someone like Steven Spielberg? Or do you get into sort of work mode?
Yeah, you get into work mode. There is a thing where you forget that they're actually in the room because you're so used to seeing them without being able to actually talk to them. But I had this, like, when we did the Adam and Joe show years ago and we first met Jonathan Ross. He would say something to you and we would just stare at him and forget that he was actually there. Do you know what I mean? Because you're so used to seeing him through a screen. So you can get into a sort of weird stargazing trance, but also there's the creeping terror of, oh shit, I'm writing a film for Steven Spielberg to keep you engaged.
Right. And now we're on to the third film of your programme. What's that going to be?
The third film is going to be Ingmar Bergman's Fanny and Alexander, the TV version.
Alexander called you dead for it.
it's long, so I can delay the inevitable. And also, it is such a beautiful film about family and family life. Part of the story is young Alexander and Fanny being taken away from their family when their father dies and their mother remarries this terrible sort of preacher man, and they end up in a very cold, frightening, abusive situation. But it's bookended when their mum finally gets them out of it. It's got these bookends of incredible warmth and love and all the sort of mess and chaos and affection of family life. And then it's so beautiful about his imagination. And there's a scene when he's at his father's funeral and he's walking along in front of the coffin and he's just saying, shit, piss, fuck, shit, piss, fuck. He says the C word as well, I think. And I saw it when I was quite young, and that really struck me as a brilliant, weird thing for a child to be doing, and so truthful. Mm. It's such a great movie. And, you know, I'm not a Bergman. I've got that massive Criterion set. I haven't watched many of them. But people always said that Fanny and Alexander is a brilliant sort of compendium of his themes. Mm. So I'll just stick with that one.
Can you remember what made you choose to watch that in the first place? Was it a chance encounter, or was it something you'd had your eye on for a while?
I just went to see it at the cinema. I really liked just seeing characters of my own age in films. I guess because the first films I saw was The Black Stallion and E.T. Mm. Like, I'm about the same age as the character in E.T. And it was so powerful to me as a child to see another child in a story as sort of transportive and as exciting as that. These days, young people have to make do with Chris Hemsworth in spandex as their avatar. Do you know what I mean? Mm. One of the things I really like about the new Avatar is it has those teenage characters who behave in quite a relatable way despite the fact that they're blue and living on Pandora. Mm. I really like that, seeing a version of myself on screen. And yeah, so maybe that's why I saw Fanny and Alexander and then by accident got totally wrapped up in quite a sophisticated, famous art film.
Now, before we move on to the final film, I'm going to ask, who would be on your sort of guest list for your last picture show? Who do you kind of love going to the cinema with?
Hmm. Well, you know, the terrible truth is I like nothing more than going on my own.
Okay.
Because there's nobody else to worry about. You don't have to worry about whether the person you've bought is enjoying it. Mm. And I really like going to matinees when the cinemas are maybe not too full. Mm. Because I like to really lounge and I don't want anyone nearby me to create a disturbance. I like to get really absorbed in the film. The most frustrated I get is when I'm watching a really good film and somebody is being a jerkhole next to me, you know, or looking at their phone. So they would have to be people like Edgar, you know, my DOP Tom Townend, like my friend David Cox, who runs the Film 4 channel, people who really love movies. Mm. My wife Annabelle, she would behave very well. Not my three-year-old daughter. I don't think she would have the tolerance. Yeah, so just people that really love movies and would concentrate and eat sweets out of fabric bags that don't rustle. I don't know why they don't have fabric bags in cinemas.
No.
That sort of papery fabric, that cheap papery fabric you can get, you know? Come on, puppets. Pull your finger out. Do puppets still exist?
I did find some recently, but I don't know if they were like brought back or if they've just never gone away. But talking about going on your own, do you sort of like to come out and not have to share your feelings on a film straight away as well? Or
I have a bunch of people I would immediately text.
Okay.
And share opinions with. But I used to love as a child the feeling of walking out of the cinema as if you've just got off a plane from another planet, you know? Mm. Such a weird, discombobulating feeling to have been in someone else's life for 2 hours and then suddenly walk out onto Streatham High Street.
And now, time for the final film of the programme.
Yes.
What are you choosing?
Well, this is my upbeat, triumphant musical out. So I've chosen Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Phantasmagorical musical entertainment in the history of everything.
Oh,
Chitty Chitty Bang Bang is a magical car, a craft that sails the seas, a flying machine that speeds through the air.
Directed by Ken Hughes, written by Roald Dahl, produced by the Broccolis. It's basically a junior Bond film with gadgets and even what's-his-face who played Goldfinger is the villain, Baron Bonblast. It's a fantastic movie. My daughter loves it. She knows all the songs. I grew up with it. I know all the songs. It's widescreen. It's long. It's got action, adventure. It's another film in which young people, all the kids in the cellar of the castle in Bulgaria, rise up and overthrow the adults at the end, which seems to be a recurring theme. It ends with a revolutionary act by the youth. And I love it. I would remake it. I think you could do better with Truly Scrumptious. But it's such a great, beautiful, lavish, amazing film.
So you wouldn't consider it like a sacred cow? You'd be willing to put your own spin on it?
I mean, it is kind of a sacred cow, but we could make another sacred cow. We'd have a whole field of them. Obviously, you could do more with Chitty Chitty Bang Bang itself. You could just give Truly a bit more to do. It's very hard to beat Dick Van Dyke. I think you could do it.
Would you retain the era, or would you sort of update
make it a period movie? Yeah, I think you'd have to make it a period movie. I do. You would retain the era. Having said that, like, do we need to? My daughter absolutely loves it as it is. But it's fun to think about, don't you think?
Yeah, oh yeah. Was that one of your first films that you remember seeing as well? And was that pretty early on?
I'm trying to remember whether we saw it at the cinema. I think we probably didn't. I think we probably saw it on TV. In fact, we did see it on TV, because I only later in my life realised it was CinemaScope. Mm. So only when it came out on DVD did I realise, wow, this is a massive, beautiful, widescreen production. But we had the record, you know, we had the vinyl album, and we knew all the songs, and it's very nice to sing along with my daughter to songs that I was singing when I was 7, you know.
And I've got just a few quick fire questions to finish on.
Yes.
And so firstly, popcorn. Do you like salty or sweet, or do you just avoid it
altogether? I don't have popcorn. I do not eat popcorn in cinemas. These days I would just have some Coke Zero.
Okay.
Because I'm trying to watch my waistline. But in the old days, I love chocolate-covered raisins or peanuts or a packet of Revels, maybe. Yeah.
And do you like a lot of trailers at the cinema, or do you prefer just to be going straight into
the
film?
No, these days, because you can see all the trailers, like, I'm lucky, I've got a home cinema in my house, so I have a nice projection set up, so I can project all the trailers. So I've usually seen them. Mm. So you know what I do? I find out what time the actual movie starts. Hello, could you tell me what time the actual movie starts, please? It's usually 15, 20 minutes. Mm. And then I try and sit down as close to the actual start of the actual movie. Because movies are long now. Mm. You don't want the audio-visual exhaustion of having watched adverts and trailers. I want my mind to be sort of fresh.
Finally, if you could be having a movie soundtrack playing as everyone's leaving the cinema on this last day on Earth, what would you go for?
Holy guacamole, what would I go for? A movie soundtrack playing. I might just have the Chitty Chitty Bang Bang songs playing, just so that people stay in that upbeat. What could they be singing as the world ends? Like Chitty Bang Bang, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, Chitty Bang Bang, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, Chitty Bang Bang, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang! The last bang is the world breaking into fragments.
So, Joe Cornish's last picture show will be If, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Fanny and Alexander the TV version, and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Let us know if you'd like to see that programme of movies by contacting us on Twitter or Instagram, where you can find us as @TotalFilm. And you can hear Last Picture Show programmes from the likes of Baz Luhrmann, Joe Wright, the Russo brothers, and even some of Total Film's own writers, which are available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Chitty 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 bang bang. Chitty 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 bang bang. Chitty chitty bang bang.
Chitty chitty bang bang. Chitty
bang bang. Chitty chitty bang bang. Chitty bang bang. Chitty chitty bang bang.
Chitty bang bang. Chitty chitty bang bang.
Oh, you pretty chitty bang bang. Chitty chitty bang bang. We love you. And in chitty chitty bang bang. Chitty chitty bang bang. What we'll do near, far, in a motor car. Oh, what a happy time we'll spend. Bang, bang, chitty, chitty, bang, bang, our fine four-fendered friend.
bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang. Our fine four fendered friend, chitty bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang, chitty bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang, chitty bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang. Oh, you pretty chitty bang bang.
That was the Last Picture Show podcast from Total Film. Let us know what four films you'd watch at the end of the world. You can tweet us on @TotalFilm or connect with us on Facebook or our Instagram page.
Bang, bang, chitty, chitty, bang, bang, our fine four-fendered friend.
You're sleek as a thoroughbred.
Your seats are a feathered bed.
You'll turn.